Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to call to order the council retreat number 2 of May 29, 2015. Let's go around the room and identify ourselves for the record, please.
Doreen Marchioni.
Jay Arnold. Eric Shields.
Brenda Cooper.
Marilyn Beard. Kurt Triplett.
Tracy Dunlap.
Michael Olson.
Tom Mikesell.
Eric Olson.
Jim Lopez.
Toby Nixon.
Shelley Clova. And Amy Wallen. And Deputy Mayor Sweet is running about 15 minutes behind. She's at another event, and Councilmember Asher will not be here today. Do I need to formally ask the council's permission for him to be excused, or it's a retreat, so maybe not?
It's a council meeting.
It's a council meeting.
Probably it would be a good idea just to ask.
But at a retreat, we don't usually take formal action, right?
Well, in this case, I'll move that we excuse Dave Asher.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. We navigated that. That's the first challenge of the morning.
Excellent. We are adjourned.
Okay, City Manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor. Members of the Council, thank you for giving us this time. We're pretty excited about what we're going to cover today, and I hope you all have in front of you our Council agenda packet.
Yep.
One thing that is a little bit different than the last agenda that most of the council saw is that we have asked permission to have an executive session to discuss property acquisition. And this is sort of late breaking news regarding potential sites for the Aquatic Center. So when we looked at our agenda, we felt like we had enough capacity, and in talking with the mayor, she agreed to let us wedge that in. So that'll be sort of over the lunchtime, and I think you'll find it all very interesting. So that's kind of the one change from what you saw before, and we're going to hopefully get out of here on time so that we can all go to the grand opening of the Park Lane. And a lot of great work is being done on that, and we'll actually have an update on that before the end of the retreat as well. So with that as kind of an overview, unless anyone has any questions, I'll just go ahead and kick us off to the financial update. But any questions or changes?
We're ready.
All right, so I'm going to start off, and I'm going to turn this over to Michael Olson, our Finance Director.
Morning, Michael.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Mayor, Council Members. We'll start with a brief financial update for results through April of this year. Again, we'll take a look at the revenues, expenditures, what trends we are noticing at this time, looking ahead beyond 2015 of things that we may need to pay special attention to, updating the price of government, and then some concluding remarks. Please stop me at any time if you have any questions. This is through April, which is a third of the year, 33%. For the general fund, the revenues are at 35%, a little bit ahead of the schedule for the year, and just slightly over 10% ahead of the same period last year. So the general fund revenues are doing well. Sales tax is slightly ahead of the forecast and slightly ahead of last year's actuals. We just received May's numbers in the last couple of days, and if there hadn't been a refund to AT&T provided by the state through the settlement, we would have been 2.8% ahead for May, but May came in flat. So year to date, sales tax is just under 2% ahead of what it was last year. The utility taxes are coming in a little bit lower. We've had a very mild winter, and actually last fall as well, and so when the weather's warm, people use less gas and less electricity, so therefore less utility taxes. Development and business license fees are coming in ahead of last year's actuals, still doing well, and gas taxes are slightly below the target, but ahead of last year. As for the expenditures in the general fund, we're at 32.4% through April, which is expected for this time of year. Right in lines with budget. Again, so some of the trends we're looking at is utility tax collections. We're going to continue to monitor the gas and electric revenues to see where we're ending up at the end of the year. Another utility tax revenue that we are monitoring is the telecommunications utility tax. We believe that with more people moving to internet data communication, that is not taxable for utility tax. And so we are seeing a bit of a decline this year in the utility tax revenues as well. And the other one is fire suppression overtime. We, to keep up minimum staffing, while we had five recruits in training, We experienced overtime in the first quarter of this year. And also for backfilling two battalion chiefs while they've been on light duty. Now, in 2014, we had salary savings that covered most of this. In 2015, we are paying those recruits while they are in the academy, so there won't be the realization of as much salary savings. But I did want to note that in looking at the April and May overtime, it has gone back to below 2014 levels. So we believe that by as we track it through this year, it should be within range to cover what was already been put into reserves. Whatever's not available in salary savings should be able to be covered by what we put in reserves for this. The looking ahead part is the impacts that may occur because of the Totem Lake and Park Place redevelopment projects. We don't anticipate that this would begin until the end of 2016 and into 2017, but there will be understandably some sales tax revenue loss as the redevelopment begins, and there are potential sources to mitigate that. The one-time use of REIT that occurs from the property sale, and also construction sales tax revenue. And we will be bringing a recommendation back to the council at the end of the year as part of the mid-budget process. And let's see, I'll jump ahead to the price of government graph. When the budget was put together, we presented this to you last fall. It included the actual revenues for 2007 through 2013, estimates for year-end 2014, and then the initial preliminary 2015-16 budget. This graph has been updated with 2014 actuals and also the adopted budget that was adjusted at the beginning of the year. And so we can see that the price of government is still just above 3% and well below the normal 5 to 6% range. So not any significant changes.
Yay.
Good news. And concluding thoughts is that overall the performance is positive. The revenues are within ranges, expenditures are below budget and within expected ranges. Sales tax is not growing as rapid, but it is still growing slightly, and we're going to continue to monitor that. And we'll continue to track fire suppression as I discussed. Price of the government is doing well at below 4%, and we will have another update with the beginning of the mid-biennial budget process starting in September.
Did we mention we still have a AAA credit rating? So make sure we note that.
Absolutely. Any questions?
Questions? No questions.
Thank you.
Great presentation.
All right, so next up, I'm going to turn it over to our Deputy City Manager, Tracy Dunlap.
Okay, you're going to bring up the slides. Good morning. I'm going to sort of start out with a little bit of introduction and some context for this discussion, but this is kind of just a first intro to the capital improvement program. On July 21st, we'll be bringing back all of the projects and all of that, but we thought it would be good to kind of get a head start talking about what the process is, but mostly focusing on what the revenues are so that everybody has a common platform to work from when they're considering how the funds should be spent, particularly the ones that are restricted. And so, like I say, I'm going to start out and do a few introductory slides, and then Tom's going to walk you through each one of the revenue sources. If you have any questions or you want to talk in more detail, excuse me, feel free to ask the questions while he's going through, because we want to make sure everybody feels comfortable with that information. Then at the end, we'll give you a little bit of a summary on where the preliminary CIP stands right now. We've been meeting with the city manager, and he's making his recommendations, so all these numbers are still in flux, but we'll give you a sense of where we are right now. So with that as the context, just go back to the intro. I think that the other main point that we wanted to highlight was that there will be some funds for you to be able to work with during the prioritization process, but it'll always be important to keep those revenue restrictions in place, because all revenues are not created equal in terms of the CIP. So thanks. Yeah, if you want to go to the next one. All right, so the thing that I've been saying a lot lately is it's important to recognize that the capital improvement program is a funding plan and not a spending plan. It's basically what revenues do we have and how are they going to be deployed. And so in many cases, we might show a project funded in a year or over 2 years, but the project might take 5 years to complete. And so when we're looking at it, we spend a lot of time identifying funding sources, talking about the priorities of projects that we want to get done, but we're committing the funds so that we know they're there and we can proceed with the process. The actual process might take much longer. And the reason I thought this was important, because I know there are always questions about the cash carryovers. And one of the reasons we have large cash carryovers in between the biennial budgets is because we funded the programs. We have the money in hand, but it hasn't been spent yet. So we have to recognize those revenues as being available in the year that they're spent. And so often, and I think this is a good thing that we'll try to highlight in the document, people are thinking, well, you funded it in 2015 and 16, why isn't it built yet? Well, it may be that it was never feasibly to be built then, but the design would start in 15 and the construction might start late in 16 and it might go to 2017 or things like that. So you'll see that in a lot of the writing, I think, that you know, it's important to keep in mind that it's funding. Next slide. The project cost estimating, this is just kind of another piece of context that they're basically the best cost estimates we have as of the date of the plan. And so usually the first 2 years are adopted in the budget. So 2015 and 2016 are the most precise numbers, I guess I'd say. But even those are not totally precise, but they represent the commitments that you've actually made to funding, because you basically only adopt the actual funding appropriations in 2 year pieces. So the estimates beyond the first 2 years tend to be programming estimates. They're basically best estimates based on the information at the time the plan is developed, and lots of things can change, which you're all well aware of because you see them when they come forward. So they change and they'll need to be adjusted based on market conditions, based on the actual scope of the project. Often these are just placeholders to say generally when we develop a park, it's $500,000, but depending on what we're doing in that park, we may change the scope or change the budget once the master planning is done or the design is done. And so I think the main point in talking about this is that we have mechanisms in place to help address that uncertainty. One is that in some of the areas, particularly in public works, in the later years we have placeholder projects. Maybe something like either parks, park acquisition, or in public works, sidewalk repair or sidewalk maintenance. We don't know exactly which ones we're going to do after the next 2 years, but we're setting funding aside to do that because they're more opportunistic or needs will emerge. So that's one way to deal with it. The second way is that the further you go out, the more contingency there is built in the estimate. And so the closer you get to real design and real understanding of the requirements, you don't need as much of a contingency. But you want to be careful of putting too much contingency in because you're tying up revenues, if you do it prospectively, that you might be able to put to work. And so there's kind of a delicate balance, but the further you go, the greater the contingency. And lastly, we have reserves set aside, and that's probably what you see most often is when we get bids or we get actual master plans finished, staff will come forward and ask for supplemental funding. And that's what the reserves are for, is to basically give you the flexibility to respond to either changing market conditions or changing scope. And so I think the important takeaway from that is the use of the reserves should not be viewed as a failure of the process. There are times where that may be the case, but I don't think that's generally the case. It's just sort of a natural outgrowth of the process, and that's why we keep the reserves. This is kind of important as we go through talking about the revenue side of things, because we're still trying to keep, we're trying to deploy some of the balances that we have so we can get more projects done, but we're also trying to preserve a good reserve level so that we are able to respond when the project needs change. So the next little bit of context is, this is the current CIP. So this is the 2014 update of the 13 through 18 capital improvement program. And as we very often say, we've identified $730 million worth of needs and we've funded $181 million, which leaves an unfunded CIP of over I hate to say this, $500 million. But the more we've talked about this internally, the more we really wanted to sort of shine some light on what unfunded means. If you want to go to the next slide. It really means they're not funded in the six-year window. And the six-year window is what the CIP focuses on. The master plans that form the basis for the big, long project lists are 20 years or more, the ones you've been looking at. And so it makes sense that there's an unfunded level. Actually, in the capital facilities plan, we look at the 20-year picture. But it gets, if the expenses get fuzzy when you go out past 6 years, the revenues get even fuzzier in terms of the ability to be precise. So what we're looking at is, in this CIP, maybe refining the categories a little bit, talking about unfunded in at least two main categories. One is projects that are after 2020, essentially, but would be candidates to be funded from the regular revenue stream, but isolate out those projects that we really would likely not do if there wasn't a large external funding source or a new funding source. The most obvious example of that would be the ARC. If we don't have a voted revenue source, it's unlikely we'd have revenues to be able to pursue something, you know, between $50 and $60 million. Other examples might include a whole modernization program for all the fire stations, which I think we're seeing an estimate of $25 or $30 million. Substantial development of the corridor to the $90 million program. We would expect we'd have to get very large federal grants, things of that nature. And so sort of isolating out those very large chunks so that when you see this unfunded number, it doesn't look quite so daunting, because there's going to be funding from year 7 to year 20, which will make progress on those projects. So we're working on that. But in the end, the funding that we have right now, and again, these are all subject to change as the city manager makes his recommendations, about a quarter of the funding comes from the utilities, basically for the utilities projects. And I think we spend so much time talking about the non-utilities projects, we forget how much of the work that really comprises. You know, they're often with some of these other street projects or things of that nature. But, you know, all the rest of the revenue sources are kind of distributed. We have a good source of external revenues. We have good grant funding and some developer contributions. We use reserves, which we've accumulated from some of these revenue sources, and Tom will kind of give you an overview on that. But the sources are pretty distributed aside from the utilities, and so that's just kind of an interesting context as we go into talking about each one of the revenues. So that's kind of my introductory comments. I just wanted to pause and see if there were any questions, and then Tom will kind of get into the meat.
Question, Mr. Nixon.
Yeah, to go back briefly to your discussion about contingency levels for projects, do we ever go back and kind of look at historically, you know, what did we originally estimate or provide for contingency, and how much money did we have left over, just to see if our contingency policy needs to be updated, either increased or decreased based on how close our estimates have been?
I might look to our Public Works Director.
I'm over here.
There you go. Oh, you moved. Oh, sorry. Didn't see you move over there.
Joe, could you answer that?
Yeah, exactly.
flexible and nimble. That's Public Works. That's something that we are planning on doing as we move forward. There are industry standards, and I wouldn't want to vary too much from those because, you know, some years you might get lucky and you didn't need the contingencies, and others you don't. So at certain phases, like at the planning phase versus a 30% design phase, there are standard contingencies that we wouldn't want to move from. But I definitely want to look at how much revenue are we tying up every year with contingencies, and how might we more efficiently deal with that.
Yeah, that's kind of why I thought of it, was that Tracy was talking about if we have the money tied up in a contingency, we can't use it for something else. So.
Yeah, and Tracy and I have talked about how, you know, there are different ways maybe of doing appropriations on larger projects so that we don't tie up as much. But okay. Moving forward, we'll look at it.
Thanks.
Others? Mr. Arnold?
In our packet, there's a breakdown of different areas where CIP projects are, transportation facilities, et cetera. And in comparison with other cities, the general numbers seem pretty consistent. Transportation is number one for all the peer cities, et cetera. Would it be possible for us to get some information from previous CIP to see if those numbers have changed?
If our number has changed over
time? Yeah, I mean, for example, our, you know, I think about with the Justice Center, would that have meant that there was a bigger public safety component in the CIP from 2 years past?
You know, interesting you should say that, because we were just talking about this. We don't actually show facilities as public safety. We show it as facilities, but we can do that because we think we're going to make that change and move the fire stations, for example, into the public safety CIP instead of having it in the facility side to be a little more functionally clean. So that would be a really good context, I think, to present that information when we describe that change, because it will look a little different than in prior years.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Kloba.
More just a comment. I really do like the idea of taking that unfunded chunk and differentiating between the things that are likely to have the be accomplished with the funding that we know is coming versus additional new sources. I think that helps to understand what the challenge is in front of us. So thank you for looking at it that way.
Thanks.
Okay. So, good morning. As Tracy mentioned, I'm going to walk you through the various detail of the funding categories for the CIP. And the discussion is going to roughly follow the pie chart in terms of the time that I'm going to spend. But there are a few categories that there's more in terms of the restrictions that may be in place or the revenue assumptions that are being made. So I'll spend a little bit more time on those. So REIT is you know, one of our larger revenue categories. It's basically an excise tax on the sale of real estate. And by its very nature, it's a volatile tax base. And you'll see that in demonstrated a few slides later. State levies a rate of 1.28%. The city is allowed to levy two different rates, two quarter percent rates, REIT 1 and REIT 2. Which we do levy both of those. One of the restrictions on the use of REIT is that the project that we use REIT for needs to be in the capital facilities element of the comp plan. So that, you know, that's one of the first boxes that we need to check when we program revenue for that. Also, this is not necessarily a restriction, but it's more of an allowance that the state has recently given us. As you're aware, we can use some REIT monies for O&M expenses through 2016. The criteria on that, it's basically the greater of $100,000 or 35% of our total amount available, up to a cap of $1 million. We use about $200,000 per year in our budget. So that's a clarifying point about use of REIT. There are also some specific definitions in state law about the uses of the each quarter percent. Next table shows
I'm going
this.
To jump in for just a second to highlight that getting the REIT flexibility extended has obviously been one of our priorities in the state legislative discussions. It wasn't on our original top priority list for this session, but a bill has emerged and the legislative committee is tracking it very carefully, and we're trying to see if we can get that flexibility in the final budget discussions. If that doesn't happen, you know, and who knows at this point what will actually happen, we are likely to propose that getting REIT flexibility be one of our top priorities for the council's legislative agenda for 2016.
So this chart just basically displays the allowable uses of REIT, REIT 1 and REIT 2. So as you'll see, REIT 1 has a broader list of uses, transportation projects, also recreational facilities, and various general governmental and public safety uses. REIT 2, on the other hand, is largely restricted for transportation uses. There is some use available for parks, but no land acquisition, and no usage is allowed for general governmental facilities.
So one more jump in here. So a lot of times you'll hear us talk about we trying to harmonize the REITs. This is what we mean, is there's no particular reason they shouldn't have the same definition of categories they could be spent on. So we talk a lot, and the AWC talks a lot about they should both all have the same yes and no boxes, and hopefully all the yes boxes. So that's probably a second piece that we'd like to get some harmonization of the two REITs.
So this is a snapshot of how we currently budget REIT in 15-16. So to start off, we the revenue assumption that we've made is $5 million per year in both years, and that's based off of our recent experience. In 2014, it was about $6.8 million. However, from that $5 million, we only actively budget for use about $2.5 million. So portion of it is for the O&M purposes, as you'll see in the REIT 2 box, both Parks O&M and Transportation O&M. And then we take REIT 1 in the CIP, allocate 2/3 of it to Parks and 1/3 to Transportation. And then with REIT 2, it's 100% used for Transportation. And so the question is, what happens with the remainder of the $5 million minus $2.5 million? So what we have done with that in the budget, we basically allocated that to reserves, basically for use in this process. The table at the bottom shows how we started this this fiscal year in terms of REIT reserves, the addition of the 15-16 revenue, and then certain amounts that we've programmed in through the CIP process to date. We have two target balances in each of these funds, and so these reserves are basically available for grant matches as grant opportunities come available, so we can have money to make the match, or other high priority uses that come up during the year. So we kind of set that aside and kind of give you a sense of what's available in both buckets of REIT. So this is the roller coaster ride of REIT. That kind of shows how volatile the tax base is. So going back to 2000, we started at a level of about $2.5 million, and then with the housing bubble, it grew pretty rapidly up to about $7 million in 2006. Peak to trough from that point down, it was about $5 million drop. And so now we've been building back up in recent years. However, even with the annexation area added back in, we haven't reached the peak that we achieved last time. So one of the kind of things to point out about this graph is you can see there was a plateauing period in the 2006 to 2007 timeframe. And if you look at 13 and 14, it's kind of similar. So it's difficult to say, you know, the future is difficult to predict, but right now, current revenues through 15 are strong. You know, we've gotten Toten Blank sales revenue that was high, and that helped. And there's no current indication that revenues are dropping off. But this just is a kind of a this is the challenge we face when we're forecasting REIT. Like, what's the number that we choose? So then get into the revenue assumption. What we've assumed for programming. So we looked at King County. So our revenue base is highly correlated to what happens in the King County revenue base. It's like 79% correlated. And, you know, it's clearly not the same revenue base, but the same kind of market forces affect both. REIT's very volatile. And as I indicated, the peak to trough variance from 2006 to 2009. King County is actually forecasting a consistent trend from 2014, so they're basically assuming it's going to be flat at the high level, which is a difficult assumption, but you know that's what they're assuming. What we're assuming at this point is more of a through 2016 kind of a high level, but then back down to the 2.5, 2.6 that we currently budget in the CIP for 2017 through 2020. So. It is a dropping off, but it's a very conservative assumption. It kind of assumes that we will be able to support the projects that we program.
And I just wanted to jump in a little bit to say it's not as though we won't program the difference if more comes in, but we'll bring that back after the fact so it's there. And one of the reasons that we recommend doing it this way is if you program it in at the high level, you create an expectation that the projects will be done. And for market forces that are out of our control, you may have to come back later and say, oh, never mind, the revenues didn't come in. And many cities got caught short in that big decline between 2007 and 2008 in having to vastly unfund projects because they were assuming that revenues might continue at that higher level. So we have a mechanism to recognize it, but it's a little more backwards looking. We try to have a fairly consistent level, and then as we generate more, we can bring that forward, because we do update the CIP really every year. We do it comprehensively every other year, and then we bring back an update. So it's not like they are idle, but they do build up the balances.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So I assume that like when Prudential changed their development partner in Park Place, that was not a REIT generating event. But when CenterCal acquired Total Lake Mall, was that a REIT generating event?
It was.
That's probably a fairly big chunk.
It was a $35.5 million transaction, so about $177,000 in REIT. That's the number that Michael was referring to, that we're thinking that we might want to set aside separately as a hedge toward the debt service that we'll have to support once Totem Lake is finished.
Yeah, it was kind of my question. What I was leading to was, do we treat those big chunks specially in any way versus kind of the ongoing normal month-to-month REIT collection?
You know, we haven't treated them separately, though in the original Totem Lake discussions, there was a discussion of setting it aside and making sure that it was available. So I think it's a good practice. Some of the transactions, we have no idea. The largest transaction, there was a $100 million sale of an office park down by Yarrow Point.
Wow.
We had no idea, you know, other than we saw this big piece of REIT, and they have no particular plan. And just to answer your question on Park Place, because it was part of their existing agreement, it didn't change hands. But I believe that the way it works is, if more than 50% of the ownership changes, it's subject to REIT. So occasionally we get REIT payments that come through a separate mechanism where they've changed general partners or something like that, where it might still be the same ownership, but there's been a change of hands of the percentages.
But it's triggered by like a deed being filed with the county or something?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe that's the case. And that's why I say they come in a whole, the ones that are changes of ownership in excess of 50% come through a whole separate mechanism. We get different kinds of notifications and all. So I'm not quite sure what triggers that, but we are aware of those kinds of transactions if they're significant.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so moving on, I'll look a little bit here at impact fees and how we, the various restrictions and how we program those in the CIP. So impact fees are basically charges on new development to help pay for the improvements that we need to make to our infrastructure to keep up with the demands from the people that come along with the new development. Restrictions, essentially, anything that we use impact fees for needs to be in CFP, in the comprehensive financial plans, capital facilities elements similar to REIT. Mm-hmm. We need to spend them within 10 years of receipt, and they must actually, the projects that we build using impact fees need to benefit the new development for which they, to which they were assessed. We have a transportation and parks impact fees, which we do program in the CIP. We also have school impact fees, but we pass those through the Lake Washington School District. So these are the current impact fees. So a little bit of history. They were established in 1999, I believe, they were set at a rate of, I believe, 50% of the cost recovery. In 2007, they were updated to 100% of cost recovery, and then an inflationary index was added. And this is where we stand right now. The inflation index wasn't applied from 2013 forward because of the recession. So there's just a, you know, as you're aware, there's a discussion about the parks impact fee policy, and this kind of governs how we can program it in the CIP. So last update to the CIP, we didn't program any revenue from parks impact fees because of the restrictions on how they could be used. Right now they're being used to, that park impact fees are being used to repay debt service. So in recent years, the collections of those impact fees have been far and above what we've needed to pay the debt service. So we actually have in balance enough to just fully pay those two debt obligations, the McAuliffe and Teen Center. So our current assumption in terms of how we're programming it is that we'll use a defeasance. So basically we'll set aside the money to pay off the debt and kind of wipe it, take it off our books and clear the way for the new policy if council decides to go in that direction. So
can I just jump in for a second? I just want to explain the defeasance. You know, the idea would be we could call the bonds, basically totally pay them off, essentially. But these bonds were refinanced to get a more advantageous interest rate, and so they can't be called at this point. So a defeasance is kind of a term of art that we would take the money and set it in trust, so it's no longer, the cash is no longer on our books, but you invest it in some sort of vehicle that generates sufficient interest to pay off the bonds. And so it actually comes off our balance sheet in its entirety, but the revenues go to a trustee and the debt comes off the books. You'll need to take an action, or we'll be bringing you an action to do that, but we think it may be prudent to do, because that way most of the impact fees collected under the old method will have been used for the old uses, and then most of the, and then the impact fees that will be done under the new method we can program in for the new projects. So that's kind of the logic behind it, but that'll be a separate action we'll bring back sometime probably in the next month or two.
So these are the revenue trends basically since the inception of the impact fee program. I think you've seen this graph in a prior study session. So in 2008, despite the change to the impact fees in 2007, they actually went down for three successive years, basically as a result of the recession. Now they've built up in recent years, and transportation's about a $1 million per year level. Parks are approximating to $750,000 per year. And, you know, it was actually, in transportation terms, it was higher, but a big chunk of that was from Google. So, kind of it took that out in terms of determining what the average was. So this kind of leads into our assumptions of what we're programming. So for transportation, we're assuming about $1 million per year from basically through the 6 years of the CIP. That's increased from $350,000 per year. We were using a lower amount, so we've actually built up some balances that we're also programming in the CIP. One of the unique factors of impact fees is if the development slows, then the impact fee revenue will decline. However, the need to build the projects to keep up with the development also declines. So it's sort of like a feedback effect. So there's a little bit less risk in terms of upping the revenue assumption from $350,000 to $1 million. Park impact fees, $750,000 per year. This is increased from zero because, as I mentioned, we were not programming anything. This assumes that the policy of that we'll pay off the debt, kind of clear out the existing balances, and we'll have a new policy on basically doing the assumption of per capita parks versus what currently is the policy. So next is property taxes. So we have, as you know, two property tax levies that we build into the capital budget. We have the city and the park and the road levies. We have a growth assumption for both of these levies. Both of them have capital and operating components. As you can see in the table, kind of how those break down between the two different budgets. In terms of the general revenue source, we apply a 1% kind of policy, state allowed growth in the levy, and a 1% new construction assumption. In the in terms of the road levy, we have a fixed $2.6 million per year that goes to the CIP from that, and the rest goes to the operating budget. We have in our terms of programming actually revised what we're doing with 2017 through 2020. We're basically allowing the growth to benefit the CIP share also, because right now we have it fixed. Parks levy, on the other hand, it actually is designed that way. The park contributions to the CIP were based on a certain set of projects that were included in the original ballot language. There is $1.25 million per year that's set aside. Any growth in the levy goes to the operating budget, with the assumption that in future years the money from the revenue comes in will be used for O&M costs and not capital. So that's by design.
And part of the logic in that was the costs grow faster than the 1 or 2%, and so over time those lines will cross. So once the projects are done, we'll end up potentially using some of the capital dollars as well far out into the future, but it's a way to try to keep it sustainable so that you don't end up with the same property tax issue you always have, which is that the costs grow faster than the revenue itself.
So there's a third property tax. This one is actually the King County Parks and Open Space Replacement Levy. It was approved in 2013. It expires at the end of 2019. So cities receive 7% of that revenue on a per capita basis. And right now we have it programmed to repay the Yuppie Pawn Shop loan from the general capital contingency. However, we'll be able to fully repay that by the end of 2016. So there are, through the end of 2017, I'm sorry. And so we have potentially two additional years of revenue to program for that. Based on current trends, that should be about $300,000 per year. We're not assuming that the levy will be renewed in 2020, but that's just in terms of how we're programming the money.
And we'll do many updates between now and then.
So that concludes property taxes. Next type of funds are life cycle funds. So these are sort of our internal mechanism to keep up with our needs to repair and replace our equipment and infrastructure by way of charging our operating funds. So it's kind of smooths out the operating contribution to provide sufficient balances to make large capital purchases. So one of the larger ones is the facilities life cycle fund, which is assessed to all the operating funds, operating departments, based on their usage of facilities to set aside money to repair and replace our buildings. Next major fund is technology equipment sinking fund, which is for servers and basically IT equipment, things of that nature. Public safety equipment sinking funds. We have two different ones, police and fire, and those are basically to replace the larger equipment in those two public safety operations. And then the equipment rental fund is essentially our fleet replacement fund. And the way that the money is generated for each of these funds is sort of the same way that we use the money. So we have this model that basically says in 10 years we need to make this big purchase. So we kind of smooth that out and collect money over that 10-year period so it's available in year 10. So we look at that same model that we used to determine how the contributions are made in order to program it in the CIP. So it's kind of a the model that drives how we collect the money is what we also use to program the money in the capital budget. So it's sort of a life cycle sustaining process. So reserves. So these are our mechanisms, and these are in addition to the REIT reserves that I discussed earlier. These are our mechanisms to kind of set aside money for large kind of one-off things that are not covered in our life cycle funds. So first one to talk about is the major systems reserve. So this is for technology purposes, and we started the 2014 with a balance of $656,000. We actually budgeted a $500,000 addition to this fund, and we programmed utility tax money from an audit also into this fund. There are a few programmed uses, so help desk replacement, recreation registration system, and finance system assessment that we have programmed in, but we're showing we have about $976,000 remaining in that. That's unprogrammed at this point. However, we have some various purposes that this money could be used for in the future. So the building property reserve, so this is for large building property purchases and building improvements. This maintains a minimum balance of $600,000, which we have budget, that is our budgeting assumption right now. We also have about $1.5 million in this that's set aside for City Hall. And then the street improvements reserve, which is gas tax revenues in excess of forecast received over the years. So we've been accumulating balance in kind of recognition of this kind of large process we have. There's about $1 million available in that reserve. So utility charges and fees, I believe if you kind of think back to the pie chart that Tracy showed, this was our largest revenue category, but it's also very restricted in how it can be used. It's it's largely confined to uses for utilities. One of the revenue sources is connection fees, which is essentially charges to people who connect to the utility to kind of adjust our infrastructure for the fact that we have a new user. So across all our utilities, that's $865,000 per year of the CIP. Utility rates. So these are, you know, the rate covers both the operating and the capital side of the utility. You know, the operating covers the normal O&M, you know, the year, day-to-day operations of the utility. The capital piece is based on depreciation. So it's as the infrastructure ages and we recognize that we need to replace it, the depreciation schedule accounts for that, and the amount of money that we build into the rate in the rate study incorporates that and accumulates the money necessary so that when we need to make a large replacement, it's there for us to use. That fluctuates from year to year based on how much, what kind of improvements we need to make. So there's not really a set amount. In 15-16, I believe it's $3.6 million. So there are a couple rare exceptions where we use specifically use utility money in other areas. One is solid waste street preservation. So this is basically solid waste utility paying money into the street fund to you know, kind of repair streets in recognition of the fact these big trucks are driving and potentially accelerating the deterioration. It's $300,000 per year. Also surface water. So large transportation projects often have a surface water component to them. So we put money in from the surface water utility to recognize that and to have money available as we build transportation projects. That's $500,000 per year. So debt, there you go again, is kind of an interesting one because it's not necessarily a new revenue. It's in a large part, it's more a way to structure and channel an ongoing stream of revenue to have an amount available to do a much larger project with. There are six types of debt that we have access to. First one is limited tax GO debt. So this is councilmanic debt, and it's councilmanic in that the council can authorize and use this debt without additional voter approval. One caveat about this debt is that it's paid from our existing revenue stream, so it doesn't come with any new money. The term of the debt is unlimited. However, it's normally 20 years, and in any case, our policy restricts it to the normal life of the project. Councilmanic LTGO debt is the one largest issue that we have currently under outstanding. In a few slides, I'll kind of show you the total spread of how much debt we have by different categories. Unlimited tax GO debt. So this is voted debt. So this does come with new revenue. It comes with a specifically dedicated property tax to pay the debt. However, it has a 60% voter margin requirement, and it needs to be approved by a minimum of 40%. The election has to have 40% of the voters in the last most recent general election. So that's a restriction on that. There's no limit on the term of the debt. It's matched to however long the project life is. Levy lid lift bonds. So these are somewhat similar to unlimited tax debt. These come with new property taxes. However, it's got a 9-year limit, so it's sort of a much shorter time frame.
Simple majority vote for that.
Correct. 50+1. So there's, you know, it's a less restrictive voter margin, but it's a shorter period. So LID bonds, and just to back up, we do not have any levy lid lift bonds at this time, nor do we have any LID bonds. So this is debt that is backed by properties that specifically benefit from the improvement that you make. And one of the challenges with this type of debt is that the payment from each individual property owner has to be equal to the increase in the assessed value that they receive from the improvement. So it's kind of difficult to match those two things up in all cases. I don't believe there's any limit on the time frame that you can issue this for. Revenue bonds, this is most typically used in the utilities. So it's basically, we have a revenue stream that's specifically dedicated to repay the debt. with certain coverage ratios, and we do not currently have any of this debt. And Public Works Trust Fund loans, so this is money from, it's a state revolving fund. It's highly competitive where we can apply for a loan and then draw down money as we need it. And this is limited to a 20-year term, and I believe it's largely used in the transportation and utilities.
So I have a question on the local improvement district bonds. So if we wanted to construct a municipal parking garage in the downtown area, would we be able to show that nexus to an increase in property values?
It is extremely challenging for parking garages because those buildings with high valuations probably already have the parking that's required of them, so the value doesn't go up. The ones that were not required long ago to put the parking in are the ones that would probably see the increase, but the relative cost of parking in proportion to those buildings is very challenging. I think the things that I've read have said that there's a fraction of it that you could probably generate, but it would probably be a third or less of what it would cost to pay for the bonds. The other thing is you have to draw the boundaries in a way that might be a little challenging in our downtown because we have such a mix of old and new to determine who benefits. There are people who have great expertise in LIDs, and I am not one of them, but you basically hire outside experts, hire assessors, essentially, to go out and look at it. But it is not a magic bullet to that. It might be one tool in the tool chest, but it will probably not even get you the majority of the funds. It would probably get you fraction.
And there's not enough revenue from parking.
Yeah. I think one of the many studies we've done kind of put forward that you'd maybe get a third from an LID, a third from mandatory parking, and a third would still have to come from general tax dollars. And I think that actually that proportion has kind of held through a couple of those studies that we've done.
Thank you.
So this table kind of pulls all of our debt outstanding as of the end of 2014. So we are limited by state law to issuing debt no more than 7.5% of our total assessed value. And that's 7.5% is broken up into three categories. So the first 2.5% is for general purposes. The second 2.5% is for open space and parks. And then the third is for utilities. So within that 7.5%, there's 1.5% that can be issued using councilmanic debt. And so that's the two breakdowns that are shown here. So within the councilmanic capacity available, we have approximately $198 million. And in terms of our total debt capacity, we have $1.1 billion. So we have quite a bit of capacity.
So this is one of those good news, bad news things, right? Because you see this number actually in our financial statements, and it appears in many ways. So the $200 million in councilmanic capacity, we've only used less than $40 million of. The bad news is you have to have revenue to pay the debt service from existing sources. So it's really not an answer unless we identify what revenue stream from existing revenues we'd want to dedicate. And similarly, and actually probably on an even more dramatic basis, the amount of voter-approved capacity we have is huge, and that's really a factor of our assessed valuation being very high, you know, well over $1 billion. But again, all of those bonds would be voted with 60% approval and would be a separate property tax assessment. So we have capacity. It's really a revenue and a revenue issue on the councilmanic side and a tax tolerance issue on the voted side.
I have a question about this. So I'm actually kind of surprised to see the District 41 bond listed there as a councilmanic bond for the city. Because it was a Fire District 41 debt, does it really count against the city of Kirkland's debt limit? And especially because it has a separate dedicated property tax stream that's paying that debt service.
Because it passes through our books, the auditor has kind of come down that we show it there. Okay. Both the revenue and the expense passes through our financial statements. It does have its own revenue source, but it is not an excess levy. It's sort of a remainder of an existing levy.
Right.
So it's none of the above, I guess, okay. is what I would say. But this is okay. We're required to do it in the financial statement this way, which is where that comes from.
It might be interesting in a future version of this chart to show the maturity dates or when those different things will be paid off.
I think the one in the financial statement might actually have, the full table might actually have that.
Okay.
So this just, I believe you've seen this type of chart before. This just shows the impact of $1 million of debt issued under a variety of terms and types. So the levy lid lift, Councilmatic and unlimited tax GO. So kind of piggybacking on what Tracy was saying, the Councilmatic bonds, there actually is no impact in terms of tax rate shown because there is no new tax that comes along with that. So just the general takeaway is longer term, lower annual payment, but of course you're paying for it longer. So this is just a rule of thumb. So these kind of rounds out the categories that we use in the CIP. So first is gas tax. So we actually collect a larger amount of total gas tax, about $1.7 million. This is the piece that goes into the CIP. We have it growing by 3% per year. The state rate is 37.5 cents. It's interesting that revenues have not been picking up with the lower price in gas because this is on a per gallon basis. So it's interesting. Used in the transportation program. Business license fees also used in the transportation program. So this, in the past, the $270,000 came from the sales tax. However, based on your policy decision, beginning in 2015, this has been replaced with business license taxes to kind of reflect the contribution of business license fees to keep up with infrastructure at the streets. And the general fund also contributes to the CIP in a few select ways. One is we had a debt service for the parking garage, about $390,000 per year. That debt was fully retired at the end of 2014. So beginning in 2015, that's been redirected to the Walkable Kirkland Initiative. Beginning in 2022, that is part of the strategy to deal with the expiration of the annexation sales tax credit. So for the term through 2020 of the CIP, it's available. It's used for Walkable Kirkland, but in the future, it's part of that strategy. $3 million on a one-time basis. So this is essentially money that sales taxes were doing better in 13 or 14 than what was budgeted. So money was set aside in the budget to help pay for fire station options through North Kirkland. And so to round it out, external revenues. So this is also kind of volatile. It depends on the available grant programs at the state and federal levels. We have a number of different programs that we participate in, Department of Ecology, Commerce, WSDOT, TIB, and finally developer contributions. So when we work on large projects, when developers sometimes contribute money to us, that also can be budgeted in the CIP to help fund projects.
Any questions on the details? Because I'll sort of jump in now and wrap it up.
Okay.
With the big table here. So if you can't see this table, it's on page 43 if you want to see it in a little more detail. One revenue source that we didn't list on other sources, but it's kind of an interesting story, is interest earnings. Interest earnings used to be quite a large revenue source to the CIP. In the 2007-2008 biennium, interest that we earned on the city's portfolio was well over $9 million. In the 2015-2016 budget, it's less than $2 million, projected less than $2 million, and that's on a larger portfolio balance. If interest rates were to return to higher levels, we might be able to program some of that in, but that was one of the really more significant impacts of the recession. Is the good news is we can borrow cheaply. The bad news is we don't earn much on our money. And a portion of that was set aside toward investments in information technology and investments in public safety facilities. And so that's one reason we're pretty constrained in our funding in those two categories. And that'll continue to be a discussion item in the CIP. But small enough that we're not even showing it on the list. But we hope it'll get better. So this summary, I just wanted to walk you a little bit through the summary table here. The available column there is the reserves and the revenues for the six-year period that we have. So some of it's money in hand, some of it's money in future time frames. So that's that first column of numbers, $185 million, a little bit higher than what we have in the current CIP, but that's sort of the pot we have available. The program column are the projects that have been recommended by the Park Board, the Transportation Commission, the staff, and the city manager. And the city manager had the luxury of getting this when there was more available, and then he programmed some of it. So he'll have projects that he's added in that'll be part of the preliminary CIP. So the numbers you see in that remaining column are ones that we have not programmed yet. We've also taken out the reserves, particularly in REIT. We have a required reserve balance by our fiscal policies. So what you see in that remaining column are the cash balances in the second to last column that we haven't programmed into the CIP yet, and the revenue in future years that we haven't programmed into the CIP yet. So what remains is primarily REIT 1 and some impact fees, parks impact fees. The $976,000 in the major systems reserve, we've been debating whether to show, because we really think we need to hold on to that, because the next major system we have that is getting a little long in the tooth is the finance system, and $1 million will not buy you a finance system. And so we would probably recommend not programming that and continuing to find ways to add to that balance. Our current system was put in place in 1999, so we'll be looking at that. Hopefully after I'm gone, but we will be looking at that over time.
Yes, but so, Trixie, in the future, will we put aside, for our systems, are we putting sinking funds aside?
We're putting sinking funds aside. We do it for the desktop. We do it for the infrastructure. We have not done it for the systems, partially because it's a very, very large number. We've looked at that. We actually looked at it when we established the infrastructure and the public safety reserves. And so what we have been doing, and I think this in the distant past was true too, is when we have cash, uncommitted cash, available at the end of a biennium, this is one place we look to put it. Or if we have unexpected cash, we got those utility tax payments, the one-time payments for the annexation area, tax telecommunications companies, and we just put those in there because they were unanticipated and wouldn't be recurring. We could come up with a dollar amount. Any dollar amount is sort of a good dollar amount, but that would come out of other revenues, if you know what I mean, or other programming. And so at this point, the other thing is, I think the life that you usually put to systems like this is 10 years or something like that. None of ours are ever replaced in 10 years. As I say, we're in year, what would that be, 16 of the finance system. We were 20 years, I think, in the permitting system. And so we've looked at a bunch of different ways to do it. I think the number was $1 million a year if we were actually to do a sinking fund. So it dwarfed all those other infrastructure needs, but I think that's a good policy discussion, is do you want to put a set amount aside on a regular basis just to recognize that those things are out there?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a little frustrating to think that you're relying on unanticipated funds to replace things while technology is evolving so dramatically, and I don't know. What do you think?
I think a couple of things. It's one, it's a little bit harder to know exactly what the number is for major systems, because as Tracy mentioned, some of them last 20 years instead of 10, some last 5 because of acquisitions or other problems. So it makes it a little harder than, say, servers, where we are, it's a little bit easier. And there's so much change. But we certainly do need, I think, to have more money set aside and perhaps a different different way of finding that at some point in the future. That would make me sleep a little better. But I'm not exactly sure how to come up with that number. And we've worked out a number of different things and never found one that wasn't just stunningly large. So we have to sort of think through how do we make something like this work.
So I would just add, one of the reasons I asked Tracy to highlight the interest earnings, because that was a big category that used to tip money into these because it was so large and it was basically unaccounted for other than, so we use it for this stuff like this. One of the reasons we're so focused on reserve replenishment by 2018 is that is another long list of categories of things that can be used for this when stuff comes up. So it's a very legitimate policy discussion we need to have about how much you want to set aside. But in the unlikely event that a year from now, you know, we had to completely replace the financial system, even if we don't have enough money in the major systems reserve, we just come back and say, here are the places we need to think we need to pluck it from. So it isn't as if we're completely exposed. And so it's that same challenge of do you strand a lot of money over here when you don't know exactly how much you're going to use or when you're going to use it. But we all, I mean, one of the great ethics of Kirkland has been set aside regular amounts of money to be ready for this. So we definitely want to do that as well.
And I think that's what I was going to add, is that I think if interest earnings recover, we would think that that might be a first call on interest earnings. If the interest earnings were start to, or the interest rates were to start to rise, which has been predicted, you know, for over a year, but then the economic news is never quite good enough, and the rest of the world economy is doing poorly enough that they haven't raised the rates. But if interest rates started to go up, even if they got back to sort of normal historical ranges of maybe 4% or something, 4 to 5%, that would dramatically increase. I think we're earning, what now, 0.8%. So if we could actually get 2 or 3%, that would be a substantial amount of money, and I think that would be a good, we can maybe talk about that as part of the policy discussion, is as it recovers, this might be a good first call on a portion of that. All right.
I just make one last comment on this chart. So when they say the city manager is programming the money, one of the things I want to make sure you're clear about is we're using the resolution you pass as the guideline in my conversations with you. So it is things like school walk routes and focusing on the, you know, Park Place Totem Lake areas and all of those priorities that we've identified in the work program. And then I'm likely to propose to program some more of this as well before we get to you in July. But again, our goal is to then also leave some capacity for the council to take a look at what we did. Obviously, you can reprioritize it and then have some capacity to add things or invest more in certain categories. So it might be a little bit less than this by the time it gets fully transmitted to you.
So just a couple of quick closure issues. One of the things that we did was we had been approached by the Evans School to see if we might be able to help some students do a capstone project, which is their the end of their graduate program. And so we had two students who did a review of our process and looking at best practices in literature and talking to some of our neighbors. I think overall our process is pretty good. Our process uses best practices. I think what the city manager was describing, getting you to set your cross, sort of your overarching policies so that you're prioritizing among categories, was one of the best practices they highlighted. And so I think that's a big stride toward it, toward the achieving that best practice. And we'll be presenting the information in that category. We'll be taking those categories and saying, here's how we use that policy guidance to prioritize across the different categories of projects. The one thing that we found intriguing that we don't have a formal process of was having sort of an interdepartmental team that reviewed the whole picture. Right now, each department meets with the city manager's office and finance and reviews it, and then that group looks at it on the cross priorities basis. The city manager's office and the finance folks look at it on that basis. But we thought that was an intriguing way to get a different perspective and have the departments talk to each other about how to break those silos down and the prioritization across the categories. So we thought we'd look at that a little bit more as we move into the next process and see if there's a way to build that into the process. Because right now there's a lot of review that happens on the CIP. The Park Board weighs in on the park projects. Transportation Commission weighs in on the transportation projects. But there's a whole host of things that are out there that there's not a forum that the staff discusses. So the fire stations, for example, or the IT projects, how do we make those? Maybe articulating that a little better in the staff discussions would be something that would be helpful as we go through the process. So that was kind of our takeaway from that exercise. We're looking at a few other policy issues that I won't talk about in any detail, but making sure that capital and operating is in the right place, that we're not budgeting ongoing operating costs in the capital budget. One of the interesting policy questions that comes up in that council member Arnold brought up at our finance committee meeting was that may become quite a large issue in IT, that as software becomes a service, it goes from being a capital purchase to being an operating expense. And so that has a bearing on that whole discussion of how much should we set aside for systems in the future as well, because whether it's one-time revenues or ongoing revenues would have a bearing there. We're looking at making sure we understand what the project management needs are. We recover sort of our internal project management costs through an overhead on the projects, so the capital improvement project engineers charge there. Because as we do more capital projects, we need more capital project managers. So we're taking a look at that and making sure, and I think there are temporary positions that have been identified to help us make progress because we're doing a lot more capital than we've done in the future. Unfortunately, it always comes when the market is good, and so we still have some vacancies, but we're going to be looking at that and working to address it. And so last but not least, where we are in terms of the process. So once we finalize the preliminary CIP recommendations, Tom and his staff will be busily creating the CIP document, which will have a narrative of all of this and highlight how the policies that you've set are reflected in the preliminary work. We'll try to get that to you early so you have time to look at it, because it'll have big project lists and all of that for you to contemplate. We'll have a study session on July 21st, and basically we'll have a public hearing on September 1st. So that July 21st we'll present the preliminary and what the decisions are. We'll be able to tell you what balances remain that you might want to program and what the key decision points are. But then you can take public comment in September. We'll have another study session because the numbers always change, not just because of your policy choices, but because circumstances change. We might get a grant that moves something up or back, or we find something else out. Right now we're scheduled to adopt the CIP with the budget, essentially. So at the final meeting of the year, whenever that is, we'll bring you the final CIP. So that is our introduction to the CIP. Any questions for us?
Mr. Nixon?
Yeah, so personally, I think that the involving the community and the prioritization in the neighborhood safety program has worked out pretty well. And I'm curious if we've thought about how we could do something similar across the CIP, both within silos and across silos, to get more feedback from our citizens on which projects they think would benefit them the most. I realize that there's going to be some things in the CIP, like a decant facility, where people might not be able to imagine how it helps them at all.
But
what do you think about ways of getting more public input into the CIP prioritization?
Well, we have been thinking about how to do that. I think the key to remember is that this year in particular, we've actually built the CIP around all the processes that had tremendous public input. So we're using the transportation master plan that had really extensive outreach. So when people came forward and said, greenways, we need greenways, you know, you're going to see that in the six-year CIP as an example. The parks program, the parks comp plan, and things like the Edith Moulton Park master plan. So to a certain extent, when we haven't had the master outreach for the CIP as we've put it together in the six-year CIP, it's really based this time in particular on all of the 2 years of public input in the comp plan and the master planning processes. But we can always do more and better. So I know there is a overview of our communication outreach plan on the CIP that we have here, so we'd welcome feedback on how to do better. But we definitely want to keep reaching out constantly. But this particular CIP is the result of quite a bit of that.
Just to preview, that's what I was just going to say, just to preview one of the things that will be in the CIP, I think Public Works has really put in place a refinement to their process to be able to take the suggest a project information and overlay it on the program needs. So that's what I was going to suggest. Maybe the Public Works Director could speak to that, because I think it's really very effective.
And this is our first year trying to integrate all of those sources of input into one CIP. And we did have one open house to take a look at the 20-year plan and the transportation master plan to get public input on priorities. And we had a pretty good turnout, and people did come in, and they had specific sites that they were interested in, but also they were very interested and supportive of the general shift towards non-motorized and trying to do things to address traffic impacts in the city. So that was good, and we'll continue with that. But in this CIP, there were so many projects that addressed multiple program areas and multiple priorities. It was pretty easy to pluck off the it was lower than low-hanging fruit. There were mm-hmm. projects that, you know, might be a school pathway, and they might also be in a 10-minute neighborhood and be a suggestion of the neighborhood safety program. So this CIP, it was easy to find the priority ones. But as we move into the next years, we will be integrating the neighborhood, the Suggesta project, the neighborhood safety program, all of those.
Right.
It's been a good process, and I've been very impressed with the community engagement and input. It's been really good.
Just highlight two other mega examples just to show really how much it really is linked. It would be the 100th Avenue Corridor Study and the Winnetka Drive Corridor Study. So those came from the community. The council authorized the money to do the studies. Big lists came out. We sought grants. We got grants. So, you know, it's not that we're sitting out here creating these things. It's that we're really responding to the community in terms of how we set up the list.
The tougher problem for me is, like, how do we choose what's more important, all the relocation of fire stations and the public safety issue versus
right.
building the ARC? Especially the really big things, which do we go to the public for first?
Yeah.
And that's I think if you're talking about, you know, a variety of sidewalk projects or whatever, that's one thing. But when you start talking about the really big ones that are expensive to even ask the question, that's tougher. So I'm just thinking about
sure.
how do we address that too.
Ms. Kloba?
Well, moving away from the big scary questions, the small one, as I was thinking about the Suggesta project, I've looked at the site. I haven't actually suggested one myself. Is there a communication back to the person once they submit, or does it sort of just go into the hopper and they assume? What does that look like from the sort of the user perspective?
That's an area that we do need to improve. People put in projects and there is a long list right now, and we're putting together a database and a process by which we can get back to people and let them know this might be addressed through maintenance, this might be addressed through CIP, or this really just doesn't rise to the level to be addressed. And so that communication loop needs to be improved.
Okay, thanks. And I'm interested in how it would work if you had, say, a very energized and active neighborhood association that was suggesting a whole bunch of projects, and then you have another neighborhood association that doesn't happen to be so well organized. How do we do that? And I know we do a good job of that, but I would just express that concern that there has to be some fairness and some equity.
Absolutely. There needs to be fairness and equity, and we all need to look at prioritization criteria. As I said, this year it was pretty easy because there were so many projects that met multiple needs, and it was easy to pick the highest priorities. But as we march on in the years, this will be a super high priority for us.
Thank you. Okay. We're ready to move on.
So we're at about 11:20,
We have an executive session starting at 11:30. I didn't know if you wanted to, and then we have an hour, and then we have another break. So I didn't know how much discussion you wanted to have on the police strategic plan scope, and whether you wanted to have a brief conversation about that before we go upstairs and get a little ahead.
Do we want to do that before we go upstairs?
Do you think it'll be in 10 minutes?
I think it might be more than 10 minutes.
Do you need more than 10 minutes?
Wander up with a 10-minute break then.
Yeah, and so just sort of a process check, the executive session is in the Rose Hill Room, and so the lunches are out on the table if you want to take your lunch up and have it while we have the executive session, but there's also a half hour after the executive session if you want to do that as well. But they're out there now, so you can take them up, and we'll reconvene up there.